is the fact that there is like a growing awareness that, you know, this kind of blooming or blossoming of connection with China is based on the assumption that China's rise is continuing. But in fact, we know that one of the most key elements that actually is going to affect on the short, medium term, the relationship between China and the region is the fact that China is facing a deep structural economic crisis that may require an economic correction.
People in the global north, being like China's popularity around the world is cratering. Look at how unpopular they are now in the Netherlands and in Belgium and in Luxembourg, you know, only looking at Europe, for example, or only looking at rich parts of East Asia. So that narrative, using polling in that narrative is really common. And then on the other hand, the opposite as well, which is like, oh, China's super, super popular across the global south, cherry picking country after country, which is, again, it's a much, much more complicated, you know, situation on both sides, and using polling to tell this kind of like geopolitical story is a complicated thing.
It seems to me that, at least from what we can understand, of course, there are pros and cons in observing the Chinese debate on the region, both because we assume that it usually mirrors to some extent the thinking among policymakers, but not, of course, in all its aspects.
When you talk about the way that the Chinese media and scholars and even the government have been framing post-October 7th events, so much of it seems to be an extension of the great power competition with the United States, including the relations with Israel. How much does the great power competition affect Chinese understanding of events in the Middle East today, Enrico?
The China Global South podcast is supported in part by the Africa-China Reporting Project at Wits University in Johannesburg and by our subscribers. Thank you. If you'd like to subscribe for daily news and exclusive analysis about every aspect of China's engagement in Africa, Asia, and throughout the developing world, go to chinaglobalsouth.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the China Global South podcast, a proud member of the Seneca Podcast Network. I'm Eric Olander in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, and as always, I'm joined by China Global South's managing editor, Cobus van Staden, in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good afternoon to you, Cobus.
Good afternoon.
Cobus, we got word last week that China is back in the Mideast diplomacy game. You know, since the beginning of the Israel-Hamas war on October 7th from last year, the Chinese have really only played a marginal role in the diplomacy. And everybody's been looking for the Chinese to take on a bigger role. We talked to Bill Figueroa a couple weeks ago about what they could do with Iran. But for the most part, the Chinese have sat on the sidelines. However, we found out that representatives from the two major Palestinian factions, Fatah in the West Bank and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, are in Beijing. They arrived last Thursday, and they are there for talks, what they're calling unity talks. And this is really very, very important, because getting the Palestinian factions to align is absolutely critical if there's going to be even the prospect of a two-state solution, something that the U.S., Chinese, a lot of people, except, interestingly, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, agree is absolutely essential for any type of long-term stability. Cobus, you'll recall that in 2023, the Chinese also brokered the deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We've talked a lot about that on the show. But if they're able to do something on the Palestinian side, it could be a major breakthrough.
It really could be. I mean, that is also a big if, one has to say, because, I mean, there's few kind of more complicated fights than that particular one. But of course, you know, the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia was also quite a long shot. And in the process, you know, like some people were saying that China, in brokering that deal, you know, despite the fact that there's kind of back and forth about how much China actually was responsible for the deal itself, but you kind of leave that aside for the moment, like the fact that China brokered that deal was a really landmark achievement and reshaped, you know, Middle Eastern diplomacy to a certain extent. So, you know, this will be a much even bigger achievement, but I think also with much longer odds, I think.
It's really a no-lose proposition for the Chinese, because if they do make a deal, wow, that's amazing. That's incredible. But on the other hand, if they don't, well, they can say, we tried, and everybody's tried at some level, including the Palestinians themselves, to try and bring them together. So In some ways, I see why they're doing this. Also, let's not forget that the Chinese are in many ways uniquely positioned to do this type of mediation, in part because of their close relationship with Iran that has the close relationship with Hamas. I'm not entirely sure if it's a straight backing, but there are strong ties between Hamas and Iran. At the same time, the relationship with the Palestinian Authority and Mohammed Abbas and Fatah goes back all the way to the PLO days. So they are much better positioned than, say, the United States or Europe to have these kinds of conversations with Fatah and with Hamas. So something to keep an eye on. But as we're talking about China in the Gulf and China in the Middle East, it's really interesting because when we look back at 2023 and 2022, we have seen a major shift of investment, of engagement in this region. And Kobus, you and I have been talking about China-Africa for more than a decade now. And one of the things that we've seen is the energy buying has moved from Africa to the Gulf. Consider the fact that when we look at the list of China's top 10 energy suppliers, six come from Gulf countries. Trade with the region is surging, and not just in the energy sector. The value of overall trade between China and Arab countries reached $431 billion in 2022. That is more than double what it was a decade ago. And China's trade with just the UAE, just the Emirates, which is, of course, home of the booming commercial hubs in both Dubai and Abu Dhabi, is forecast to reach $200 billion a year just within the next 6 years. Absolutely incredible. So when we think about this relationship, a lot of it comes down to narratives. And Kobus, you focus a lot as a media scholar on narratives. I think the issue when we talk about narratives in the Gulf, it makes it more complicated because so much of the media there is controlled by the state or by ruling parties, much like the Chinese are. So the framing of China in Gulf countries in many ways is a mirror of what the governments actually look like or their policies on China. But there is a fantastic new report that came out, Power Shifts, China's Growing Influence in the Gulf, Key Trends and Regional Debates in 2023. It was written by the China Med Project. They're old friends of ours on the show. We feature a lot of their China Med Observer reports on our website. And what the China Med team does is they look at Mediterranean governments and Mediterranean media and how they perceive China, and then they analyze how Chinese scholars and Chinese media perceive and frame engagement with Mediterranean countries. We have two of the authors of this wonderful new report that came out, Enrico Fardella, who's director of the China Med Project, and an associate professor at the University of Naples. He's joining us on the line from Paris today. And we're thrilled also to have our old friend, Andrea Giuselli, who is the head of research at the China Med Project and an assistant professor in the School of International Relations and Public Affairs at Fudan University in Shanghai. A very good day to both of you. Thank you for your time today to join us and talk about this great report you guys have written.
Thank you guys for having us.
Thanks a lot. It's a great to be here.
It's great to have you. Enrico, let's start with you. Give us an overview of the report and what are the key trends in terms of how the Gulf regions are looking at China. And then Andrea, maybe we can have you to flip the table and talk about how Chinese scholars, Chinese media are looking at the region before we get into the country by country breakdown.
Yeah, thank you so much, Eric. Yeah, in our report, we try to track down a little bit the debate that went through in the last year, 2023, which was a critical year. As you know, this is a year where we can say that China updated its presence in the region to a certain extent, became a complete actor in the region. Certainly, as you mentioned before, Chinese economic presence has been growing, but is already like a very mature phenomenon all across the region. But China is becoming more and more a more prominent, political and security actor in the region. And given like the current crisis in the area, of course, it's very interesting to see how the different countries are positioning and how they interpret China's potential role in this sphere. As always, the debate is very variegated. And so we can't say that there is a unique trend. What is interesting, however, is the fact that certainly there is more and more optimism. In general, China's presence in the region is quite welcome. And generally, most of the authors in the Arab countries, as much as Iran, they look at the China's potential role in the area as a political security actor, as a balancing factor that can somehow correct the traditional presence of other actors, first and foremost, the United States.
Andrea, let's get your take from the China perspective of all that.
Sure. Well, I think the debate, somewhat the Chinese debate on the region, has been kind of mirroring what was the regional debate on China, in the sense growing optimism in general, both on China's role in the region, China's presence in the region, the success and effectiveness of its policy, as well as in general about regional trends. Of course, up to October 7, I would say that the main things that we can see, I would say the most interesting probably, although I would say also most natural, really, trend that we observed and we pointed out in a section in the China chapter of the report, is really the growing centrality of the Gulf in the Chinese discourse. Of course, this is not to say that before the Gulf was not important and so on, but we can see there's really a lot of investment in this relationship with Gulf countries. I would say especially with Saudi Arabia, something that caught the attention, my attention, but also that of the other member of the team that contributed to this fantastic report. And in general, of course, the attack on Israel by Hamas in October was something that somewhat part opposed this optimism. But in a way or the other, there's still this impression that this is just a temporary stop to what they say the wave of reconciliation in the region, this kind of general distension of the relations, especially, of course, in between Tehran and Riyadh, which is also, I would say, implicitly seen as a bit of a legacy of Xi Jinping's foreign policy in the region, which, of course, Chinese commentators are keen to emphasize and highlight as really a pivotal point in regional politics, which was, but of course there's special importance for them. They're very good to say this attack and these tensions and so far and so on are just attempt again something that has temporarily stopped this process, but we are still confident overall about the trends that we contributed to create.
So before we dive into the, you know, the country by country issue, I wanted to ask both of you how you feel China's position has shifted since October 7th in the Mediterranean area, and particularly what you also make of this news of Hamas Fatah, possible Hamas Fatah talks in China. Like, what does that indicate to you if you look at the current crisis?
Yeah, I think China's position, I would say, has mostly been that of, in a way, two-pronged kind of action. On one hand, really trying to protect, again, the legacy of the agreement between the rewarming up of the renormalization of the relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And once that was done, we've seen it, right, with calls between Beijing, Tehran, and Riyadh, trying to ensure that all the parties are fine with what is going on, especially, for example, with, we've seen it recently with, for example, after the Iranian attack on Israel. So on the one hand, that's, it's a more the defensive part of the Chinese approach to the post-October 7. On the other hand, of course, a very firm, I would say, position on the fact that whatever happens, the attack in the Red Sea and now these tensions and attacks and counterattacks between Israel and Iran, this is really not about Iran. This is really about, again, what's going on in Gaza. The United States should not try to kind of distract the international public opinion pointing to Iran. Should look at itself, of course, its support for Israel and so far and so on. And so this is, in a way, I think Chinese policymakers are actively trying to, on the one again, protect what they've achieved, but at the same time also score important political and diplomatic point in the region and outside, in order, you know, trying to really emphasize their support to the Palestinians and really putting the blame on the United States. Of course, perfectly aware that is a very thorny issue also domestically for the Americans, and is something that again brings a lot of the public opinion of many countries again in the region, but also outside, together. And the Chinese are quite eager, of course, to capitalize on that. As to these recent meetings in Beijing, I have to be honest, I'm very surprised. I cannot deny it. I agree with, I think it was Cobus earlier saying it's quite a long shot. I feel this is really a long shot. But again, I also agree with the idea that after all, at least they can say they tried it. And so in a way, tell to the West and the Americans especially, we have been doing something at the very least. Maybe not what you wanted, but we have been doing something.
But to be fair, if you asked me in 2022 if Iran and Saudi Arabia were going to meet in Beijing to sign off a deal on reconciliation and détente, you would have thought I was crazy. So I'm not suggesting that you guys are wrong. I'm just saying crazy things have happened in this space already before. So who knows, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're totally right.
And they don't necessarily have to like each other. They just have to get along just enough to be able to govern, which seems hard to believe in the current environment, but everything is different today than it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you're totally correct. But again, surprised once again, I would say that.
All of us, yeah. Fair enough. Enrico?
I think actually you're right, Eric. The situation changed dramatically. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, of course, the role of China in the last few years has become like much, much more incisive in the region. So I think that generally speaking, the anti-American rationale, of course, explain overall, you know, the Chinese posture on different crises and different scenarios in the region. But what is interesting is to see like an acceleration in a less neutral stance. For example, like in the case of Gaza, it's very clear, as much as in the Israeli-Iranian issue. And China trying to propose and construct and build and design and favor an alternative, I would say, strategic and security design for the region. I would call it like more a sort of Islamic united front. And this somehow explains also their effort to, of course, the negotiations and the brokerage of the Saudi-Iranian relations as much as the attempt to mediate between the different Palestinian factions. So the idea is that it's clear, and if, for example, it's interesting to see how the Chinese commentators interpreted the October 7th and what happened right in the month that followed October 7th as an attempt, a sort of now-ever attempt by Hamas to impede the consolidation of the Israeli-Saudi axis. So on one side, you have like United States, Israel attempt, you know, to coordinate with Arab countries and therefore isolate Iran. On the other side, you have an opposite configuration, you know, that is being developed by Beijing of an Islamic United Front that, as a consequence, has to isolate the Israel and therefore minimize the capacity of the U.S. to exercise influence in the region. So this translates into, if you compare, for example, the language that Chinese diplomats are using in the Middle East vis-a-vis what is happening on the Ukrainian front, I think that the language, I mean, it's quite clear that in the Middle East, China is taking a much more assertive stance.
When you talk about the way that the Chinese media and scholars and even the government have been framing post-October 7th events, so much of it seems to be an extension of the great power competition with the United States, including the relations with Israel. How much does the great power competition affect Chinese understanding of events in the Middle East today, Enrico?
I think a lot. I mean, with Andrea, we just published a very interesting, besides the report, a special issue of Middle East policy that is actually touching upon this topic, which is a special issue on the role of the Gulf in the Sino-American rivalry. And I wrote a chapter, an article in this issue together with a Chinese colleague, Shegan Zheng from Tsinghua University, is a Middle East expert, and on the long durée of Chinese policy in the region. So I think that if there is a factor that can help us to somehow organize the different actions and initiatives that China is taking at the regional level is the anti-hegemonic principle. And so all the policies, traditional policies that China has been taking, like from the Mao's time until today, they are very much coordinated by this idea that, you know, the more independent forces are being generated at the regional level, the less space there is for U.S. influence, and therefore there is more security and more capacity for China, you know, to exercise influence at the regional level. So I think that this is a key factor that, you know, can help us also interpret China positioning in the region. For example, this is something you can also see in how China balances its actions vis-a-vis Gulf countries and Iran. I mean, remember what happened in the joint China-GCC declaration at the end of 2022 when Xi Jinping visited Saudi Arabia, and there was this very interesting declaration which it seemed that China was siding with the UAE on the disputed island that are actually controlled by Iran in the Gulf. Iran was furious about it, but it's clear that China is trying to gain leverage among the Arab countries. You know, some commentators in Iran are saying that China is doing this because, you know, the flow of energy from these countries is much less at risk to U.S. sanction than the one from Iran. But generally speaking, China has a much stronger leverage over Iran and needs to compete with the United States to gain more leverage in the Arab countries. And I think that this is useful for China as much as for Iran on the long term, because this is, helps China to somehow implement the vision that China has, which is, as I said before, the formation of an Islamic United Front that is designed to minimize and marginalize U.S. influence in the region.
From the Gulf powers' perspective, what are they trying to get from China? You know, one of the issues that comes up a lot as we, you know, kind of I try and read as much as I can about, you know, kind of about these different countries' relationship with China. And one of the things that comes up a lot is just the breadth of investment that falls outside of traditional oil and gas trade, particularly between the UAE and the Saudi Arabia and China, you know, kind of where there's investments in, not only investments, but also kind of different kind of corporate connections in green energy and AI and all of these kind of emerging fields, which, you know, provides a quite a kind of a much broader view of what the relationship is about. So I was wondering what do, you know, powers like the UAE and Saudi Arabia hope to achieve from China or from working with China?
Sure. So again, this is something that, again, is mentioned also in, not just in the report, it's also mentioned the special issue that Enrico just talked about. We have a couple of excellent articles about this by, for example, Mohammed Al-Sudairi, Mai Al-Faran, Mohammed Bin Waidin, and so on, that really touch on this issue. And I think, Jen, you know, there is this win-win thing going on, right, in Chinese diplomatic rhetoric. But I think, you know, when we look at the current relations between China and GCC countries, especially the UAE and Saudi Arabia, I think it is a quite good description of what's going on, in the sense that both sides are getting what they really want. Not necessarily out of, let's say, you know, sharing of particular ideas or ideologies or anything else, but really because China offers that very important thing that is economic and to some extent also, of course, diplomatic diversification that is so crucial to the economies of these countries, of course. And so I think this plays pretty well, all this, again, this diversification, expansion of economic ties beyond energy, which of course remains crucially important because after all that provides hard currency to Gulf countries while, again, energy, of course, for the engine of the Chinese economy. But really, this is more like a means, I think, to the goals that the GCC, again, UAE and Saudi Arabia, for example, want to achieve. Possibly, for example, also trying a bit to reinvest this into the Chinese market through investments on, although truth be told, this is, again, this from the paper by Mohammed Al-Sudairi and Mai Al-Faran, is still, of course, a very nascent and slow trend. There's no such thing really as decoupling going on. More like, again, diversification, finding alternatives of alternative opportunities for investment, alternative sources of technology, especially in when maybe the Americans or the Europeans put some vetoes, you cannot share these. If you use our technology, you cannot use the Chinese ones and such kind of things. And the Chinese instead are much more open to sharing and giving these kind of things. I think this really explained this moment. It would say a bit of a golden age of Sino-GCC relations. And they find more or less on the same side when it comes to what they need economically. And also in general, from a diplomatic point of view, I think they also share quite a lot of interest. So it's not necessarily, I would say, love for China, but definitely love for the opportunity, the alternative that China provides.
Well, while we're on the subject of diversification, let's dive into the report. It's broken down by countries, and let's start with the big one, Saudi Arabia. You called this a realignment in the report, and it used to be that Saudi Arabia basically was a one-way trade partner where the Saudis sold energy, and that was about it. What we've seen, though, is a blooming or a diversification, as you called it, of Chinese-Saudi trade ties. Saudi Arabia in 2022 was the largest recipient of Belt and Road construction money. Their non-oil trade now to China is going up significantly. Meituan, for those of you who live in China, know very well when you get your deliveries, you know, at night for your late, you know, your Xiaolongbao late at night comes on a Meituan delivery. They just started operating in Riyadh. Huawei is huge there. The solar industry is taking off, green tech, cars, you name it. So let's dive into Saudi Arabia and the realignment in many respects, because that is the most important country in the region. Enrico, tell us about the perceptions, both from the Chinese side and the Saudi side of this relationship as you documented it in the report?
Let me just connect your question with the previous one, because I think, of course, they are connected. I think that in general, what Andrea says is certainly correct. I mean, we see at a regional level, and Saudi Arabia is a perfect case. Actually, I would say, as you mentioned, probably is the most mature countries together with the UAE in the diversification and this expansion of connection with China at all level in terms of economic deals. But I think that if the Saudi, let's talk about the Saudi, generally speaking, I mean, they want to diversify, they want to hedge, but at the same time, they recognize, like everyone does, that China is the absolute leader in some field. Now there is a lot of discussion about electric vehicles, but there are a lot of other sectors, including artificial intelligence, IT, where China can certainly, and Chinese operator actors can certainly offer these countries like access to technology and help these countries to achieve modernization. On what is interesting, in my opinion, are two things. On the Chinese side, there is, of course, the capacity to contribute massively and somehow create a sort of, integration or dependency of the modernization path of these countries that is connected with Chinese technology and Chinese standards. Of course, it's extremely important also at a political level. What is striking on the other side, in my opinion, is that we are seeing step by step, but not yet at a general level, but I think Saudi scholar, at least in private conversation, they're more aware of this. And this is actually express the real independent stance that Saudi Arabia is actually implementing and is investing on in its foreign policy. And so the diversification that Andrea mentioned before is the fact that there is like a growing awareness that, this kind of blooming or blossoming of connection with China is based on the assumption that China's rise is continuing. But in fact, we know that one of the most key elements that actually is going to affect on the short term, short medium term, the relationship between China and the region is the fact that China is facing a deep structural economic crisis that may require an economic correction. And so I think that there is also a growing awareness among the Saudi experts, as much as the UAE, I would say, that in the Gulf in general, I would say also Kuwait, for example, that over allocating capitals on the connection with China may not be necessarily a very safe bet. So I think this is an interesting phenomenon that may become more and more prevalent in the months ahead.
Andrea, the Saudis' relationship with the United States is famously very complex. And, it's become even more complex during the Mohammed bin Salman era. So I was wondering how their relationship with the US plays into some of the calculations that they're making about China.
It definitely plays a role. And it's important to say that this diversification that I mentioned, that also Rico was talking about, elaborating more on that, it's important to say it's not any kind of decoupling, really. It's simply as a way to gain some room for maneuvering, well, economic terms away from oil, but also then in diplomatic terms, especially when there are disagreements or uncertainties, like disagreement with the United States or uncertainty about what U.S. foreign policy will be, as we see possible changes in the White House corresponding to possibly very large and significant differences in how the United States would behave in the region. That said, again, no decoupling really, but simply the attempt to use China to gain a more, I would say, well, some leverage, of course, vis-a-vis the United States, but at the same time also having more, I would say, put some distance, especially when there are foreign policy disagreement, or simply for one reason or the other, the Americans criticize the Saudis maybe for human rights and so far and so on. Or when, for example, the Americans carry out policies in the region, such as, for example, supporting Israel, that are not seen necessarily as positive by the Saudis. And so definitely, going back to one of Enrico's replied earlier, the role of the rivalry, it's crucial. Again, I totally agree with him, although sometimes we do not agree with all the aspects of it, but definitely agree that, especially at this point, there is very little in terms of regional dynamics that can be explained without taking into consideration how these countries, Saudi Arabia included, look at the balance between China and the United States on how that affects their possibilities and their options. Again, not to the gate agency, their agency, which of course is crucially important because after all, it's their goals that determine how they're going to exploit possible differences between the Americans and the Chinese, of course. But it is a crucial part of the calculus.
If I may jump in, the security element, I think, is very important. Remember 2019 when there was like the attack to the Saudi refineries, and we all saw like how, you know, the calculus of the, you know, Saudi leadership on the capacity of the US to guarantee security protection in the Gulf start changing. And of course, I mean, here there is space for China, especially after Iran, I would say, attack over Israel. I think this is also a process that is becoming more evident because, you know, the cost of defense for Israel, the US and UK vis-a-vis the Iranian attack has been extremely high in economic terms, and it's not something that can be sustained on a long term. So there is like a security issue that is pending the region. And in this sense, for Saudi, creating a more structured relationship, you know, for example, like you see the investment going on, for example, in downstream refineries in China and vice versa. So these energy links coupled with this diversification of economy is also a guarantee that, you know, Saudi Arabia is becoming more and more relevant for China. So in case of a crisis with Iran, certainly China is not going to side on the Iranian as much as it did in the case of Israel. So I think that there is the U.S. capacity to provide a security guarantee in the region is being put under discussion. So, and this is something that, in my opinion, will not change no matter who's going to sit in the White House. I think it's just a trend that is a structure and is there to stay. So therefore, you know, there is certainly a certain space for China, you know, to contribute and present itself as a, I wouldn't say as an alternative, but because China cannot be yet an alternative to the US, but certainly a contributor to, as it did, for example, in the agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Well, let's stay close to Saudi Arabia, to another country that is balancing the great power competition at the same time becoming a major exporter of energy and a destination for FDI, and that is the United Arab Emirates. I mentioned at the top of the show, it's skyrocketing in terms of trade. You point out in your report that it recorded $11.9 billion of FDI in 2022, more than double any other country in the Middle East. Also, the value of Emirati energy exports to China looks like a hockey stick. And you have a chart in the report that just shows a line straight up. So it's becoming increasingly important. But interestingly, there are some fascinating dynamics in the China-UAE relationship. So last year, we got word that the Americans were not happy with how the Emiratis were handling the F-35 fighter jet. And so the Americans started putting some pressure on the Emiratis. And the Emiratis then said, you know what, keep the F-35. We don't want it. Now it looks like the Emiratis may be considering the J-20, which is a Chinese fighter jet that's the fifth generation version of their own stealth fighter jet. So on the one hand, you saw some brushback of the Americans. Then just last week, we got word that Microsoft made a $1.5 billion investment in G42, which is an AI company attached to the government and the royal family. And in order to do that, they had to purge all Chinese involvement in G42. And so you're seeing this very complex dance that's going on in the Emirates. Enrique, let's go back to you and then we'll get Andrea's take on it. What are we to make of the China-Emirati relationship and what do they make of it amongst themselves?
I think the Emirati, as much as the Saudi, they are playing a very smart game here. And of course, what you said is totally true and makes sense for the U.S. to put pressure on the UAE, you know, given their historical linkage, but is also witness the fact that US regional policy is becoming more and more tuned with the general containment of China. And what the US have done with the Emirati lately, I think it's showed this quite clearly. For on the other side, I think that the position of the UAE is showing that these countries, and that's why, you know, we are focusing on the Gulf. I think that strategically, the Gulf has this capacity to maximize its aging policies, you know, by balancing, you know, U.S. interest in minimizing China's presence and China's, you know, capacity to penetrate the region, you know, economically, but also, you know, as I said before, present itself as a different security contributor in the region. And so I think that in this situation, the Chinese basically are, I would say they are doing, like, they've done a pretty good job in trying to drag the UAE closer and closer to China, and therefore forcing the US to follow their steps.
You referenced the dispute between the UAE and Iran about the islands, like briefly before. I wonder if you could give us a little bit more, like, kind of context about that dispute. And you mentioned the very kind of negative reaction in Iran to China's positioning. How surprised were the Emiratis by China's positioning around the island issue?
Well, you know, this is actually, I think, surprised us all, to be honest. You know, I'm not an expert of the Gulf per se, because I generally look at Chinese foreign policy and Chinese regional stance in the Middle East. So probably, you know, this is basically, it's just me, but I guess that the position taken by China in that occasion was kind of surprising for everyone, including the Iranian, that were very much pissed and disappointed. And then there was a reaction by Iran that was trying to poke a finger in the eye to the Chinese by talking about Taiwan, and so comparing, you know, China opening to the UAE territorial claims with the Taiwan issue. But in the end, like, this is something that happened a few months before the brokerage, the Iraqi and Omanian, don't forget, you know, brokerage of the Saudi-Iran agreement that was celebrated in Beijing. So in the end, I think that what happened in that situation showed that, you know, the leverage that China has over Iran, this is something I mentioned before, it's definitely stronger. So to a certain extent, I think in that situation, China was trying to maximize its leverage with the UAE and Gulf countries, and knew that Iran had less capacity, you know, to react, and to a certain extent was forced to, you know, to swallow.
We don't have a lot of time left, and there's still a number of countries to get through. We're unfortunately not going to have enough time to get to all of them, but I do want to get to Iraq, because this is a country that in many respects is often overlooked in the discourse of the China-GCC relationship and the China-Mideast relationship more broadly. Interestingly, when you look at the statistics for largest energy providers to China, Iraq is usually in the top five, and it has become a major energy producer and supplier to China. Andrea, tell us a little bit about the Iraq-China relationship as your research informed you on what's going on.
So I totally agree with all you said about Iraq somewhat being neglected, whereas I think that, this is my personal opinion, it's definitely one of the most interesting relations that China has with any Middle Eastern countries, given its role, its past with the Americans, of course, and then China's role, Chinese companies' role later on, and now this gigantic energy relation that has developed. And also, it's not interesting just for that, but also because of the very particular, I would say, debate that exists in Iraq about what to do with Chinese money, essentially. And I think it's interesting because it clearly reflects a more inwardly looking country that doesn't have whose institutions do not necessarily have the strength and the capacity that, let's say, the UAE or the Saudi institution had. Again, in this case, I would refer to the paper written by Amjad Rashid for our special issue on this, really explaining how the difficulty of Iraq and its institutions in reorganizing and rebuilding and coming, you know, and their attempts to manage the many challenges that the country faces, and then how these influx of Chinese money from aid revenues and the much discussed All for Infrastructure agreement that was signed a few years ago, really, this is really the center of the debate, and how best Iraq can possibly take advantage of that, the challenge of corruption. So you see, really not a debate, not a relation that is really oriented toward what is going on. It seems to me that the definitely Chinese do not really look at Iraq as a player in regional politics at the moment. The Iraqi also are much more focused in discussing their own bilateral relationship with China, really. Yeah, there is some debate about China's position on the attack in October and regional politics, but it's really superficial in comparison to a much more, let's say, heated debate about, is engagement with China good And if it is, how best can we manage it, and so far and so on. Which again, I think makes the Iraqi case a very interesting one. This is why I really wanted to include in the report in the very first place. To in a way, you know, instead of always talking about geopolitics, let's also see how other countries are managing these changes taking place in the region, but also especially within themselves. Right. And so this Iraq remains a country that we're really keen to, you know, keep on observing, as it provides a very interesting different point of view from which we can then try to understand Sino-Gulf relations, really.
You know, just following up on that, I was wondering if you could reflect a little bit about, you know, obviously Iran and Iraq has a famously, you know, long-term, very hostile relationship. How does China balance working with both of them? Like, how do the Iran-Iraq dynamics impact on China?
Well, I think Andrea certainly has more things to say. Something I can see from the Chinese perspective, it's certainly that, I mean, I remember maybe 10 years ago when we started looking at these dynamics, a few Chinese scholars were noticing in some meetings we had in Beijing that actually the most important energy interest that China has in the Gulf, they are in a Shia-dominated region, not just in Iran, I'm saying, I mean, but in general in an area where there is a Shia majority. And this also includes Iraq. So it's very interesting to see how actually China is, especially if you consider like the role of, you know, Iranian proxy in Iraq, also in the current crisis and the antagonism against the U.S. presence in the country. I think that, of course, I mean, this is something that China takes into account. Then in terms of the Iraqi perspective, I think that it's very interesting to see that Iraq, as being such a composite country, I mean, there are very fervent, you say, discussion about the opportunity for China, and especially the agreement on oil is one of the most important examples. I mean, there is a very strong debate on whether the country is moving too close to China or not. But I also think that, you know, it's actually this reflects the internal division of the country, and certainly China within the country. But maybe Andrea, you can tell me whether I'm wrong or not. But my feeling is that China, certainly within the country, the main asset within the country, within Iraq for China, are certainly a Shia faction. What do you think, Andrea?
I totally agree. Especially, again, not as an expert of Middle East politics per se, but as more like a observer of the region through China. I agree with much of what Enrico said, really. It seems to me that, at least from what we can understand, which of course, there are pros and cons in observing the Chinese debate on the region, both because we assume that it usually mirrors to some extent the thinking among policymakers, but not, of course, in all its aspects. It seems to me from a Chinese perspective, at least there is the tendency to somewhat, again, treat Iran as a bit different from other countries. They only talk about it in economic or energy terms, really. It's rarely, I don't remember any specific instance of Chinese commentators really commenting on any possible Iraqi role in the region. Whereas, of course, there's much more attention being paid to Iran. And I think this speaks a bit about how also, I guess, the government then look at those two countries, really maybe preferring a more bilateral approach to Iraq, whereas really engaging Iran also with an eye on what's the evolution in the region. That said, there's still problems with security that Chinese policymakers in Iraq that definitely Chinese policymakers have to grapple with. From time to time, we find articles, not much in Chinese media, but in Iraqi media about some attack being carried out or some other security threats to Chinese companies, oil companies or engineering companies in Iraq. For example, when they try to build an airport and for one reason or the other, they build a road going through the land of some local people, for example, and they create quite a lot of friction. So these kind of issues, but it seems to me they tend to be, again, Chinese media rarely, if never, really report on them. And so it seems to me there's also the tendency to be downplay these problems and keep the relation with Iraq really low-key and focused on oil and how things go. Especially, I think this also reflects it's a bit also a product of what we observe in the Iraqi debate. It is this very heated discussion about getting too close to China or not, and what to do again. Is Chinese engagement good or not? And so probably there is the tendency also to avoid discussing about this in the public, given the sensitivity for the Iraqi political development.
The report is Power Shifts, China's Growing Influence in the Gulf, Key Trends and Regional Debates in 2023. If you want an overview, a very nice high-level overview of what Gulf commentators and scholars and media were saying, and then what Chinese media scholars and commentators were saying, this is a fantastic starting point for you. And you don't have to be an expert in political science or geopolitics or economics or energy policy to really understand what they wrote here, and is put together by the fantastic team at the China Med Project. Two of the authors on that report, we should say that there was a group of you who did it, but we were thrilled that both of you were able to join us. Enrico Fardella, director of the China Med Project and an associate professor at the University of Naples, and Andrea Giselli, head of research at the China Med Project, also an assistant professor in the School of International Relations and Public Affairs at Fudan University. And also just want to give a quick shout out that Andrea has a fantastic book out, Protecting China's Interests Overseas, Securitization in Foreign Policy. Kobus, I hate to say it, you know, when we like to recommend people to buy books, this unfortunately is one of those books that if you go to a fancy university, it's going to be in the library. But if you want to spend $112 on a Kindle edition, that might be a little pricey. But if you are fortunate enough to be in a university library, you go look up Andrea's book. It's probably going to be there.
Or you can have a place in my heart if you pay it by cash.
So that, yes, you'll win a place in his heart if you pay $112 for his book. So, but nonetheless, Enrico, Andrea, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
I got an email the other day from a listener who noticed, they said they weren't complaining, but they noticed that we're focusing more attention on the Middle East and we're doing more shows on Iran and Israel and now the Gulf. And they seemed, again, I wasn't sure if they were happy about it or not happy about it, but the fact is this is a focal point of China's outward engagement, particularly in the global South. And it's unavoidable, and it's an area that is so poorly understood. There isn't a lot of scholarship there, in part because in so many Gulf and Arab countries, the discourse about China is incredibly stifled. There's just not a lot of discussion going on. And so to get experts like Andrea and Enrico, and we've talked to Jonathan Fulton and Bill Figuerera and others, it's just fascinating. And there's a one guy that I'm really hoping we're going to be able to get, Professor Fan Hongda from the Shanghai International Studies University. He's apparently currently in Berkeley, and I'm going to Berkeley in a few months, and I'm hoping he's going to be there. And he's a guy that I'd like to get on our show as well to talk about these issues, because you cannot understand the complexities enough. I mean, you just cannot. It is so multifaceted, and I fear that the discourse in many parts of the Gulf is very simplistic. We oftentimes see a lot of narratives coming out of Arab and Gulf media that talk about, well, the Chinese are just going to replace the Americans. They're the new superpower. And that is a tragic misreading of the situation. And then in the U.S. and in the West, you see it as, well, this threat narrative that the Chinese want to displace us. And so lost in those kind of reductive types of storytelling is the complexity and the nuance that the China Med Project and their report brought to the discussion.
Absolutely. I think it's really important not only to bring the voices in the region and the Chinese kind of observers who are covering the region to quote both of them in so much detail and to really kind of give, space to explore the complexity of the debate, but also to, you know, to show how the different countries in the region are so different, you know, kind of, and they each have their own set of issues with China, and China has its own set of issues with each of them, you know, and those kind of overlap in these kind of complicated ways. And, you know, like having that unpacking is incredibly difficult to get and very, very valuable when you get it in this kind of like very like sleek package, you know, that they produce is really amazing work.
Very quickly before we go today, I want to get your reaction about a new Gallup survey that came out today. They did their annual Rating World Leaders report. And there was a surprise in that report that they said, which was for the first time since they've been doing this survey, China surpassed the United States in terms of favorability and popularity. Now, this is data that we've already seen in Africa from Afrobarometer and the Ichikovits family poll in South Africa that for the past several years has seen China's public opinion approval rating surpass that of the United States. This is the first time that the Gallup survey has found that. Both, again, very small margins here, but does anything surprise you in that?
It was interesting, and I was wondering what some of the factors involved are, you know, and I had to just assume that I guess the Gaza conflict had to be playing into this in some ways, in some countries. You know, we've seen some of these kind of shifts around the US, for example, you know, kind of in, you know, kind of a lot of countries in the global south around the crisis. And so it was notable for me. I mean, you know, always like there one also has to unpack to which, because obviously both China, the United States and other major powers, they're such complex entities on the global stage that it's always a little bit difficult to say what exactly people say when they say quote unquote China or quote unquote the United States. You know, it's like, what are they specifically thinking of?
Well, it might have been very local here. Let me just point out that it might have been less about Gaza and far more local concerns. So, for example, the U.S. standing in Uganda plummeted and helped to bring down the overall number, in part because the United States withdrew AGOA privileges for Uganda because of their LGBT policies. Also, similarly, the Chinese, you know, gained a lot of ground in West Africa, including Senegal, where we have seen a lot of engagement from the Chinese, most namely the FOCAC, the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Gathering that took place last time in Dakar. So it might be the specific bilateral engagements between the two countries and these various African countries that's having the biggest impact.
Yeah, it may well be. I mean, you know, and one can certainly see the power of both these kind of like direct positive and negative kind of interactions between these countries. But at the same time, of course, you know, the West African shift is happening at a moment where there's kind of significant displacement of traditional French influence in West Africa and a push back against US presence there as well. So the local translates into the regional, you know, kind of in these kind of complicated way that's so fascinating to see in action.
That's right. So the biggest jumps in public approval of China, and this was the approval of Chinese leadership between 2022 and 2023, get this, it went from 50% in Ghana to 65% approval for the Chinese. It went from 66 to 80% in Cote d'Ivoire, 40 to 54% in Senegal, and 65 to 77% in Guinea. So West Africa is where the Chinese seem to be getting a big lift. Interestingly, Gambia and Uganda also had big reductions in Chinese approval. So we talked about for the United States, both China and the United States went down in Uganda. That's very interesting. I think it really reminds us that we have to look at not Africa as a region, Africa as a continent, but at the national level. And there is so much diversity here. And I think that's often overlooked as well.
Absolutely. And I think also what it also shows on the broadest level is also that, you know, so frequently we have, like I've seen and I see on an almost weekly basis, I see both happening at the same time. One being people in the global north being like, oh, China's popularity around the world is cratering. Look at how unpopular they are now in the Netherlands and in Belgium and in Luxembourg, you know, only looking at Europe, for example, or only looking at rich parts of East Asia. So that narrative, using polling in that narrative is really common. And then on the other hand, the opposite as well, which is like, oh, China's super, super popular across the global south, cherry picking country after country, which is, again, it's a much, much more complicated, you know, situation on both sides, and using polling to tell this kind of like geopolitical story is a complicated thing. You know, one where, you know, kind of a lot depends on how the poll itself was done, but also a lot depends on the particular kind of narrative you're imposing on the poll data.
And who precisely are they surveying? This was the question in the ISEAS survey of the state of Southeast Asia, where they surveyed 1,000 elites in Southeast Asia. So oftentimes these polls are not necessarily representative of the public, but they're representative specifically of thought leaders, scholars, professors, government, business leaders. And so again, looking at the data is very important. And to always be very suspicious when these polling points, these data points are used to make political points. As you pointed out, you referenced the Pew survey. This is the Pew Research Survey. And they, you'll hear this over and over again. In fact, Elizabeth Economy used it to justify her argument in her latest foreign affairs article, saying, well, the United States is popular, more popular than China, based on the Pew data, which, as you pointed out, biased advanced economies and China's rivals in South Korea and Japan and whatnot, where, of course, you're going to get a more negative view. And they had, I think, Kenya and Nigeria in there as kind of a little bit of a nod to the global south, but it certainly was a majority global north or Western kind of perspective, or China's rivals in Asia perspective. So that was going to tilt more negative. So be careful every time you see these polling data, including what we see coming out of Gallup or even Afrobarometer, just to make sure that the point that's trying to be made politically is actually backed up by the data properly and put in the right context. That's something very hard to do. So anyway, we'll put links to the Gallup so you can take a look at it for yourself. We'll also put a link to the China Med article that, or the report that they did, which is absolutely fantastic, and really grateful that those guys came on to the show today to tell us all about it. And we've been showcasing all of this work in our daily coverage on the website and in the new intelligence hub that is coming very soon. Giraud and the team are working on this. This is going to be a great research hub that we're building, where we're going to put lots of long-form analysis. We're going to have all of these issues surrounding FOCAC and the Gulf and mining and all these different things, where you can really immerse yourself in data and deep dives. Kobus has been writing a number of columns and analysis for the hub. That's coming out, by the way, we're hoping at the end of May. That might be early June, so something to keep an eye on. We also have some new data sets coming out. Giraud is updating the cobalt data with 2023. We're launching a new nickel data set that's coming out from Indonesia and the team there. Antonia is putting together that. We have a new China-Africa energy map, an interactive energy map of all Chinese and investment and economic engagement in the African energy sector. So some really cool things that are in the works. All of this is available to our subscribers. Go to chinaglobalsouth.com/subscribe. Try it free for 30 days. If you like it, then stay on. We would so appreciate your support. And if you don't, well, we appreciate you trying it out. If you are a student or a teacher, email me, eric@chinaglobalsouth.com, and I will send you half off links, just $10 a month. Even a student can afford that, and you'll get all the great coverage that we're producing. So for Kobus van Staden in Johannesburg, I'm Eric Olander in Ho Chi Minh City. We'll be back again next week with another edition of the China Global South podcast. Until then, thank you so much for listening.
The discussion continues online. Follow the China Global South Project on Twitter @ChinaGSProject and share your thoughts on today's show, or head over to our website at chinaglobalsouth.com, where you can subscribe to receive full access to more than 5,000 articles and podcasts. Once again, that's chinaglobalsouth.com.